And now, from the gleaming spires of Chicago, broadcasting to Niflheim, Svartalfheim, Olympus, throughout the nine worlds and beyond, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. You are tuned to the immortal sounds of Radio Free Asgard.
You are tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 135. The Song of Rig. Listen, who can hear the sound of grass growing? The sound of wool on a sheep's back growing? Who needs less sleep than a bird? Who is so eagle-eyed that by day and by night he can see the least movement 100 leagues away? Heimdall, Heimdall and Heimdall. But who could tell it was Heimdall, that figure on the seashore, the guardian of the gods, left his horn Gjall safe in Mimir's spring? He left Goldtop, his golden-maned stallion, behind the stable door, and he strode alone across the flaming 3-strand rainbow bridge from Asgard to Midgard. It was spring and time for sowing. The god walked away from the Bifrost over soft green ground, and soon he came to the edge of the earth. All day, as the sun fled west from the wolf, he picked his way along the wavy line where the soil meets the deep sea. At nightfall, Heimdall approached a decrepit turfed hut. The evening air was quite still, but the shack was so rickety that it looked as if it might collapse if the eagle giant Hresvelg gave one flap of his wings. Heimdall knocked and swung open the roughly hewn door. He had to stoop to get under the lintel and over a pack of sacking onto the shining marl floor. It took Heimdall a moment to adjust to the rank, smoky gloom. His eyes smarted, and he retched. Then he made out a trestle table, a bench, more sacking heaped in one corner, a kind of cupboard leaning against a crumbling wall, and in the middle of the room the crouched figures of Ai and Edda, great-grandfather and great-grandmother, facing each other across the fire. "Am I welcome?" asked Heimdall.
"What is your name?" said I.
"Rig," said Heimdall.
"You are welcome," said Edda.
So the god joined I and Edda. He spoke honeyed words as he well knew how, and in no time he had won the best position by the fire. From time to time he peered hopefully into the pot hanging over it. After a while, Edda got to her feet. She shuffled to one corner of the stinking hut, poked around, and dumped a loaf of bread on the table. It was not fully leavened and was gritted with husks. Then the old woman uncooked the pot of thin broth and put that on the table, too. The three of them sat on a rough bench and ate what there was to eat. There was one who was by no means satisfied. After their meal, I and Edda and their guests were ready to lie down and sleep. Again the gods spoke honeyed words, as well he knew how, and in no time he had won the best position in the middle of the bed, with I on one side of him, Edda on the other. For 3 nights the god stayed with great-grandfather and great-grandmother. Then he thanked his host and hostess for their hospitality and went on his way. Every day the 2 stallions, Arvok Early Walker and Alsvid All Swift, dragged the chariot of the sun across the sky, and Day himself rode at ease around the world. The shining mane of his stallion skin Foxy lit up the earth and heaven. But then night tightened the reins of her mount, Hrimfaxi, and each morning the face of the earth was dewy with foam from his bit. The strength of summer weakened, and the length of the days shortened. So grim winter showed his fist, full of frost and snow and ice and wrestling winds. Soon 9 months had passed, and Edda gave birth to a son. He was sprinkled with water, and his mother swaddled him. He had raven hair, and I and Edda called him Thrall. If Thrall was less handsome than might be desired, he was certainly striking and all of a piece.
From the first, his skin was wrinkled, his hands were chapped, his fingers were stubby, and his knuckles were knotted. His face was, in a word, ugly. His back was twisted, and his feet looked too large for him. Nevertheless, Thrall was strong, and as the years passed, he made good use of his strength. Day in, day out, and all night long, he sweated in the forest, gathering wood. He bound up bundle after bundle of faggots and carted them home for the burning. When Thrall was a young man, a girl who was his equal in every way came to his hut. She was bow-legged. The soles of her feet were damp and discolored. Her sunburned arms were peeling, and she had the squashed nose of a boxer. Her name was Thyr, the Drudge. Thrall liked the look of Thyr, and Thyr liked the look of Thrall, and in no time the two of them were sitting by the fire side by side with eyes only for each other. And in a little more they had prepared a bed, a bolster and a hairy blanket, and all evening they sat whispering. That night was not the last that Thrall and Thyr slept together. They had a cluster of contented children. The names of their sons were Fjosnir the cattleman, and Kors Klur, Hrym and Kregi, the shouter and the horsefly, Kefzir, the concubine keeper, and stinking Fulnir, Drumb the clot, and Gros de Graldi, the sluggard Drot, and Legjaldi, whose legs were as thick as tree trunks, Lut, who was hunchbacked, and ashen-faced Hosvir. These 10 sons shored up the structure and repaired the fabric of the hut. They spread loads of dung over the land surrounding it. They took their turn as goatherds and at rounding up the pigs, and they all dug for peat. Thrall and Thyr also had daughters. These were Ofish Drumba, Dumpy Kumba, and Hefty-thighed Okenkalfa. The best you could say about Aranyefja's nose was that it was homely. There was noisy Yisya, and Ambat the servant. Ikenchasna looked like a peg of oak. Totruipya was clothed in rags, and bony Tronubena had legs as long and skinny as a crane. These were the offspring of Ai and Edda, and from these children came the race of the thralls. Heimdall continued his journey. He took the shortest way to the next farm and walked up to the door in the blue hour, just as the light was fading. The god knocked and entered. In the middle of the room, a fire flickered, and sitting near it, Heimdall saw Afi and Amma, grandfather and grandmother. Afi had a length of wood laid across his lap and was chipping at it with a knife, shaping a weaver's beam. The knife's blade and the pool of white shavings at his feet gleamed in the gloom. Afi's hair was combed and curled over his forehead. He had a trimmed beard, and his clothes, his leather jacket and breeches, were no less well cut than his hair. Amma was unwinding flax from a distaff, spinning thread. She stretched and she reached, absorbed in her work. She wore a band around her head, and her silver hair was knotted in a bun. She wore a simple frock and a shawl around her shoulders, secured by a handsome clasp.
"Am I welcome?" asked Heimdall.
"What is your name?" asked Afi.
"Rig," said Heimdall.
"You are welcome," said Amma.
So the god joined Afi and Amma. He spoke honeyed words, as he well knew how, and in no time he had won the best position by the fire. From time to time he peered hopefully into the pot hanging over it. After a while, Amma stopped working and got to her feet. She padded across the room to a stout oak chest and took out a loaf of rye bread and a gob of butter and knives and spoons and arranged them on the table. She dipped a large jug into the vat of beer standing by the door, and then she unhooked the pot of boiled veal and set that on the table too. Then the three of them sat to eat. After their meal, Afi and Amma and their guest were ready to lie down and sleep. The god spoke honeyed words, as well he knew how, and in no time he had won the best position, in the middle of the bed, with Afi on one side of him, Amma on the other. For 3 nights the god stayed with grandfather and grandmother. Then he thanked his host and hostess for their hospitality and went on his way.
Every day the two stallions dragged the sun across the sky, and Day himself rode at ease around the world. But then Night tightened the reins of her mount, and each morning the face of the earth was dewy with the foam from his bit. Summer's strength weakened, the days shortened. So grim winter showed his fist, full of frost and snow and ice and wrestling winds. Soon 9 months had passed, and Amma gave birth to a son. He was sprinkled with water, and his mother swaddled him. His cheeks were ruddy, and he had bright eyes, and Afa and Amma called him Carl. Carl was quick to grow, and he was well-built and strong. In time he learned how to drive oxen with a goad, and how to fasten the share and coulter to a plow. He discovered how to build huts and barns, how to dig the foundations and erect a wooden frame, and lay the turf and pitch a roof. He became a skillful cartwright. When Carl was a young man, his parents found him a wife as much to their liking as to his, the fair daughter of a freeman living nearby. On the appointed day, the bridal party brought her in a wagon to Carl's own farm. She wore a goatskin coat and a veil, and keys jangled at her waist. So Afi and Amma won a daughter-in-law. Her name was Snur. Carl and Snur equipped their farm and arranged things to their liking. They exchanged rings and laid a colorful counterpane on their bed. That place became their place. It became home. Carl and Snur had a cluster of contented children. They called their firstborn Hal, the man, their second Dreng, the warrior, and their other sons were Hold, the landowner, the freeman, Thegro, and Smith, who was a master of every craft. Bride was broad-shouldered, and Bondi was a yeoman when he grew up. Bunden Skeggy always wore his beard well trimmed. Bui and Bodi owned a farm and a barn. Bratskeg had a clipped beard too, and like his oldest brother, Seg was manly. Carl and Snur also had 10 daughters. Their eldest they called Snot, the serving woman. There was Brud, the bride, slender Svani, and proud Svari, fair Spraki, and womanly Fjord. Sprund was as proud as her sister Svari. Vif was born to make a good wife. Faima was bashful, and Restil, the youngest, was as graceful as any woman. These were the children of Carl and Snur, and from these children stemmed the race of peasants. Heimdall continued his journey. He took the shortest way to a hall nearby, and in the late afternoon he strode up to it. Its wide doors faced south, and on one of its posts there was a great wooden ring, intricately patterned. The god knocked and entered. He strode through the long passageway into the hall where the floor was newly strewn with rushes. In this spacious, gracious room, the god saw Fathir and Muthir, father and mother. They sat gazing into each other's eyes, and then they touched just finger ends. Unaware of their visitor standing and watching, Father then busied himself twisting a new bowstring, sharpening arrows, and working at the shape of a carved elm bow shaft itself. Mother, meanwhile, sat and considered her slender arms. She smoothed her pleated chemise and drew the sleeves down to her wrists. Her dress had a train. She wore a flowing blue cape and a charming cap, and on her breast were 2 oval brooches. This lady was pale-skinned. Her brow was fair, her breast gleaming, and her neck was more white than new-fallen snow. "Am I welcome?" asked Heimdall. "What is your name?" asked Father. "Rig," said Heimdall.
"You are welcome," said Mother.
So the god joined Father and Mother. He spoke honeyed words as he well knew how, and in no time he had won the best position by the fire. Mother lost no time. She held out an embroidered linen cloth and laid it over the table. She brought white loaves of finely ground wheat, bowls worked in silver filigree full to the brim with cheese and onion and cabbage, well-browned pork and horse and lamb, nicely turned partridge and grouse. The pitcher was full not of mead,
or ale, but wine, and the goblets were made of solid silver. Then the three of them sat to eat. They ate and drank and talked until after dark. After their meal, father and mother and their guest were ready to lie down and sleep. The god spoke honeyed words, as he well knew how, and in no time he had won the best position in the middle of the bed. Father slept on one side of him, mother laid on the other. For 3 nights the god stayed with father and mother. Then he thanked his host and hostess for their hospitality and went on his way. Every day the two stallions dragged the sun across the sky, and Day himself rode at ease around the world. But then Night tightened the reins of her mount, and each morning the face of the earth was dewy with foam from his bit. Summer's strength weakened, the days shortened, so grim Winter showed his fist, full of frost and snow and ice and wrestling winds. Soon 9 months had passed, and Mother gave birth to a son. He was sprinkled with water and wrapped in silk. He had fair hair and color in his cheeks, and the look in his glowing eyes was as grim as a snake. Fathir and Mother called him Jarl. Jarl was quick to master skills. He learned how to hold and hoist a shining shield and to wield a lance. Like his father, he twisted bowstrings and shaped bow shafts and loosed quivering arrows. He rode. He unleashed hounds. He learned the art of swordplay and could swim across sounds. One day, unannounced, the god walked out of the forest of slender silver birches that stood near the hall. He strode to the building and found Jarl there, sitting alone.
"Jarl," he said.
"You are welcome," said Jarl.
"I've brought you a gift," said the god.
He showed Jarl a bundle of staves carved with signs and colored red. Jarl stared at them. He had never seen such things before.
"These are the runes. This is the magic that Allfather learned when he hung on the tree Yggdrasil."
Jarl looked at the god, then the runes, then at the god again.
"Do you know the words against pain of the mind, pain of the heart, pain of the body?"
Jarl shook his head slowly.
"Do you know the words that put water on a fire? Do you know the words that put the sea to sleep?"
All that day the god explained the secret meaning of the runes to Jarl, and Jarl felt excited and ready. He thought all his life had been waiting for this moment.
"I have one more thing to tell you," said the god as the light failed.
"What is that?" asked Jarl.
"My son." The god took Jarl into his arms. "You are my son," he said.
And he explained how he had visited the hall so long before.
"You are my son, and as I am Rig the King, so you will be Rig the King. Now is the time to win land, to win great age-old halls and command a host of followers."
The god looked piercingly at Jarl, his son, who turned on his heel and walked out of the gleaming hall into the darkness. Jarl did not need to be told twice. He thought his father's words explained to him what he had always felt but could not name. He was filled with a sense of release and purpose. At once Jarl left the hall where he had lived since the day of his birth. He rode through the dark forest and over passes between frosty, forbidding crags, and in a place difficult of access he established his own hall. He gathered a group of loyal retainers.
Jarl shook his spear and brandished his shield. He spurred his horse and dealt death blows with his sword.
He brought his followers to battle and stained the soil red. He slew warriors and won land. Before long, Jarl owned no less than 18 halls. He won great wealth and was generous to his retainers. He gave them finger rings and armbands, both of gold. He gave them precious stones, and he gave them horses lean and fleet of foot. In time, Jarl sent messengers over the boggy ground to the hall of the chieftain Hirsir, and there on Jarl's behalf they asked for the hand of his daughter, Irna. She was fair-haired and long-fingered, and accomplished at whatever she put her mind to. Hirsir was delighted. After Irna had made proper preparation, the messengers escorted her to Jarl's hall, wearing a wedding veil.
and she and Jarl lived most happily together. Jarl and Erna had a cluster of contented children. They called their firstborn Bur, the son, and their second Barn, the child. There was Jod, the child, and Athel, the offspring. Arvi was an heir, and Mog, another son. There were Nid and Nidjung, the descendants, Sven, the boy, the kinsman Kund. The youngest was Conn, a nobly born son. Soon all the boys learned to play and swim. As they grew older, they tamed beasts and made circular shields, shaped shafts, and shook spears. But Conn the Young learned from his father the runes, the age-old meanings. In time, he was able to blunt a sword blade and put the sea to sleep. He understood the language of the birds. He could quell flames and quieten cares, the raging mind and aching heart of an unhappy man. He had the strength of 8 men. Conn and Rig-Jarl shared their secret understanding of the runes, and Conn was even more subtle and wise than his father. He believed it would be his right, too, to be called Rig the King, and he soon won that right. One day, Conn went riding in the gloomy, dark forest. Now and then, he reined in his mount and loosed an arrow at a luckless bird. Other birds he lured from their perches and listened to them. A crow sat on a branch over Conn's head.
"Conn," it croaked, "why do you spend your time seducing birds to talk to you? You would do better to set out on your stallion and show daring in battle."
Conn listened carefully to the crow's counsel. The darkness seemed to fall back from the clearing where he stood and to wait in the wings.
"Who has halls more noble than yours?" continued the crow. "Who have won riches greater than yours? Golden jewels and precious ornaments?"
Conn did not answer. He clenched his fists.
"Who are more skilled than you in steering their ships across the reach of the sea and the stinging salt spray?"
Still, Conn did not answer.
"Dan and damp, Dan and damp, Dan and damp,"
sang the crow. It looked sideways at Conn.
"They know what it means to temper their weapons with the blood of enemies."
Here the song ends. It is incomplete.
You know, it's interesting reading these stories, and we think of them as just that, as stories or mythology or folklore. But in a way, the story is a lot more than that, because if you go back to the 8th, 9th century, the time when the story was written, or it may have been written before that, we don't know. I mean, that's just kind of the earliest we know of it. This was far more than that. This was really history. This was a tradition, a historical tradition of the time, that conferred legitimacy not only upon the ruling class of Denmark, but the entire Danish people, from the highest to the very lowest of the thralls. Heimdall was the father, the grandfather, the great-grandfather of all Danes. And this conferred them with a sense of legitimacy as a nation. Other nations also are said to have been founded by the Norse gods. And unfortunately, those stories are lost to us. Those chronicles don't exist anymore. Maybe someday we'll have the equivalent of a Dead Sea Scrolls sort of discovery and we'll have some of these things again. But in the absence of that, this is probably the best we can do. Now, according to Kevin Crossley Holland in The Norse Myths, this is the book that, of course, that I read these myths from, he points out that Rig himself and also Dan and Damt, the names spoken by the crow at the end of the story, appear in the early king lists of Denmark. So obviously a pseudo-historical connection here is being made through the story. It's kind of a shame we don't have more of it. I'm really interested to see where this would have led. And although we have, you know, the amusing descriptions and the frankly pretty difficult to pronounce names of the thralls and of the peasant class, we definitely are seeing but almost a fairy tale quality in the discussion of Jarl and his descendants. This is very different from the other stories that we've covered for that reason. Heimdall isn't explicitly named in most versions of the Song of Rig. This is something that Kevin Crossley Holland has brought in. Other sources have said these are Heimdall's descendant. And so this was inserted into the text as Kevin Crossley Holland has edited it. As I don't know if I've talked about this before, but Holland would kind of assemble all the different versions of one of these stories that he could find and create a melange of them. He would try to incorporate the unique aspects of each version of the tale into his whole. That's one of the reasons why I like his stories. And the fact that he's a pretty good storyteller and he ties it all together really well is one of the things that I really like about this guy's work. And this story is also interesting for the fact that the original source material doesn't come from Iceland. This is something that actually comes from an entirely different part of Europe and is included for the sake of completeness. We have references to Heimdall being, you know, the Rig in other sources, but not as complete as this particular story. So I'm really glad that Kevin Crossley Holland chose to include this in the collection. All right, so it's about time to wrap up the show for this week. Thanks once again very much, folks, for listening. But before we go, I do have a little trailer here to play from the kind people over at C2E2.
The Chicago Comic and Entertainment Expo, also known as C2E2, is a convention spanning the latest and greatest from the worlds of comics, movies, television, toys, anime, manga, and video games. Bringing the best of popular culture to downtown Chicago on April 25th through 27th, C2E2's show floor is packed with hundreds of exhibitors, panels, guests such as Adam Hughes, Brian Azzarello, Eve Miles, and more, autograph sessions giving fans a chance to interact with their favorite creators, and screening rooms featuring sneak peeks at films and television shows months before they hit either the big or small screen. Join us for the best weekend of the year, April 25th through 27th. For more info, head on over to c2e2.com.
And just a reminder that Radio Free Asgard will be participating in C2E2 over on Podcaster's Alley, and we really, really hope to see you there. All right, so from Chicago, Illinois, thanks once again very much for listening, folks, and we'll see you next week here on Radio Free Asgard. Radio Free Asgard is copyright Tom Harris USA Productions, which is totally responsible for its content. The Mighty Thor and all related characters are copyright Marvel Comics. Any other characters that appear on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders. We don't own any of this as much as we'd like to. The stories covered on this podcast are for entertainment, educational, and review purposes only. If you like what you've heard on today's program, please tell your friends, drop an iTunes review, or join our Facebook group. Music from Eden, the Invincible Sword of the Elfsmith, is copyright Mott's Vent and is used with permission because Mott's is simply awesome. Radio Free Asgard should not be downloaded while pregnant, nursing, or operating heavy machinery, and we are not responsible for any damages incurred as the result of this misuse. Side effects may include being lost in a cave and finding a magical hammer and falling in love with Jane Foster. Once again, thank you for listening to Radio Free Asgard.